expand capacity. And this is also done in collaboration with former student Josh Dolans, who's at Princeton, and former postdoc Monica Michelle-Rusher, who's in the Netherlands. Okay, so this is an image of an accreting black hole that has a tilted accretion disk around it. And I'll go into great depth through talk and try to explain a little bit about what you're seeing here. So to start with some motivation, which comes from radio observations of the Galactic Center, where it's now possible to resolve the accretion flow using millimeter interferometry on the event horizon scale. And around Avery et al., you know the story, but some of you may not have heard it. So I'll cover that in some detail. And then I'll go on to talk about the numerical work we've been doing to developing a laboratory for studying physical, numerical laboratory for studying physical processes around black holes. And finally talk about an application of this work to tilted disks. Okay, so Galactic Center. This shows an optical image of the central serrating of the galaxy, and we're zooming in this press release video from the European Southern Observatory. Through a series of images now in infrared, finer and finer scales, until we reach a scale of a few arc seconds around the location of the central black hole, where it's famously possible to trace the orbits of individual stars around the black hole for a period of decades. And this is what Andrew Gaze at UCLA and Reiner Menzel at MPE have been doing for a number of years, and it's the work for which they won the Crawford Prize this year. So you can see the individual orbits here spinning around, and you can trace the orbits using spectroscopy of the individual stars, using velocity information about the stars. And you can also trace them over an entire orbit in one case. And the duration of the orbit gives you information about the mass divided by the cube of the distance to the galactic center. And the velocities give you information, roughly speaking, about the mass divided by the distance to the galactic center. And so those two constrain both the mass and the distance to the galactic center with some generosity. So here's the likelihood contours for the this for the mass and the distance to the galactic center, with a peak likelihood of around 4 million solar masses for the black hole at the parsecs. So this is important because most black holes have very uncertain mass and distance measurements, and by eliminating these uncertainties, a lot with fitting the black hole accretion. So this is, is there anyone here who speaks Greek? Okay, well,
but I've been told that one word, and that's
Bathros. What's that?
But it's very vulgar.
It is very vulgar, yes, apparently. Bathros is a hole in the ground.
Yes.
After which one throws garbage of various sorts, or makes sacrifices to the gods in the end of the world. So this is a study of black holes. I've sat through enough precision cosmology talks that I had to put this up. All right, so when we look at the galactic center, we can detect it across many, many wavelengths in a number of atmospheric windows. So it's easily detected in the radio, where it's a bright, sort of one Jansky source, it's a very bright source. And then one can continue that up into the millimeter, where the atmospheric window begins to close. The atmosphere becomes more and more opaque. And then this is no man's land. It's possible to make space-borne infrared observations of the galactic center, but there's a confusion problem there, and it's really not possible to pick out this accreting black hole source, which is comparatively. And then finally, at the nearer grid, it's possible to do ground-based work with very large telescopes using adaptive optics. And then one can pick out a flaring polarized source in the black center that has a luminosity of a few tens of solar luminosities when it's in the bright state. And it goes into that bright state a few times a day and stays there for perhaps an hour or 2 hours. All right. Then the window closes again here because there's about 30 magnitudes of visual extinction for the black dwarf center, so it's completely opaque until one gets into the X-ray, and then the black dwarf center is again detected using orbiting observatories like Chandra. And again, there's a flaring behavior. There's a quiescent state where the luminosity is fairly uncertain. And then occasional flares by factors of 10 or 30 with a frequency of about once per day. And again, a duration of around an hour or two. Okay, so just to fix ideas of what we're looking at here, I want to fix your prejudices about where this emission comes from. So this stuff over here, synchrotron, long wavelength radio emission, is probably synchrotron radiation that originates far from the black holes, hundreds of GM over C squared from the black hole at a synchrotron photosphere. And then as one turns up the frequency, this photosphere gets smaller and smaller until the source becomes fairly transparent, right around a millimeter, and at radii of order GM over C squared. So that millimeter radiation is probing synchrotron emission, we think, from the immediate neighborhood of the black hole. Then, as one goes into the infrared, next window, we see these near infrared flares. This may be synchrotron radiation, and again, because of the rapid variability, it's easy to believe that this also originates close to the event horizon, where the characteristic time scale of GM over C is about 20 seconds. And then finally, in the X-ray emission probably comes from compton scattering off the same relativistic electrons that are producing this millimeter wave emission. So millimeter wave photons run around the black hole, they're strongly lensed, and then they run into an electron with a Lorentz factor of maybe 30, and they're upscattered into the X-ray. So going back to the millimeter, it's possible to use arrays of telescopes scattered around the globe to actually resolve the source. And this shows data from a group that's been doing this, led by Shep Dolman at MIT. And this shows the flux of the source versus basically the absolute value of the K vector on the sky. So when we do this interferometry, we Fourier transform the emission on the sky, and then we lay it out as a power spectrum, and this is what's seen. And the data points here represent detections of correlations between various pairs of telescopes and various baselines. So the solid line is a model fit to the source that assumes it's just a Gaussian source in the sky. And that Gaussian fit gives a size which is actually smaller than the apparent size of the event horizon. So so this confirms that the black dwarf center source is very small, and it's also quite steady. It's not moving on the sky, so there's every reason to think that this actually is somehow tied to a emission from near a black hole in the center of the galaxy. Okay, so That was detection on a couple of baselines. And there's a plan now to put together something called the Event Horizon Telescope, which will tie together many more telescopes into this VLBI array. And again, this is called the Event Horizon Telescope. It's a press release from this January 4th that was illustrated in Gizmodo with this. I don't know how many of you recognize this. The Disney movie, The Black Hole.
So when was it made, the movie?
I think it's around 1980, maybe the late 70s. So this ship gets sucked into a black hole. And in any event, there was a lot of press about this, and the idea that drove the press release, and it's quite exciting, is to make an image of the 3D plasma around the black hole. So this motivates more attention to modeling the 3D plasma and really doing a good job of this. So here are possible targets for this Event Horizon telescope. This is Sagittarius Star, the black hole in the galactic center. This is M87. This is distance from us and angular size of the black hole on the sky. So Sagittarius Star and M87 have about the same angular size on the sky. Sagittarius A star is very close, 8 parsecs away. M87 is about 1,000 times further away, but it's about 1,000 times more massive as well. So the linear size also increases. Other than that, working at 1 millimeter wavelength, which is almost as far as you can go before the atmosphere becomes opaque, there are almost no other sources. Perhaps this monster black hole in announced the other day is a candidate. We'll have to put it on the spot. M31 is the third largest black hole in the sky, and it would require telescope space exactly on opposite sides of the Earth to the Martian moon. Everything else is small. All right, so there's motivation for modeling these pretty close. We built a series of numerical schemes to model these pretty close. They're a nearly ab initio model when the accretion rate is low. And the reason we're constrained to low accretion rate is that the interaction with the radiation field is weak. And so it's just simpler to model. Coupling the accretion flow to the radiation field is a difficult numerical problem. All right, so what's in these models is first the Kerr metric, which has two parameters, the mass and the spin of the black hole. And then for the accreted plasma, we use a relativistic MHD model. So this is a 2 or 3 axisymmetric 2D or non-symmetric 3-dimensional numerical model. It's fully relativistic, so we're not making any approximations about the sound speed being small compared to the speed of the light. And then once we run these models in which there's no interaction between the accreted plasma and the radiation field, we can post-process and calculate what the emergent radiation is, what sort of perturbation on the original flow. So from this, we can calculate light curves of the source, and we can calculate images. I'm just going to skip over this and show you a movie of one of these simulations. This is a three-dimensional simulation. This, this movie shows the logarithm of the density, the rest mass density, in the equatorial plane of the black hole. And this is one of the highest resolution simulations we've done. The scale here is a little over 1 m for the inner edge of the accretion flow for the blind spot in the middle. Our inner boundary is inside the event horizon of the accretion flow. Inside the event horizon of the black hole. And the outer boundary is at about 40 m. And we start.
Does this mean that the magnetic field straight over into the.
There are field lines that get carried into the hole, yeah. I'm unable to stop this. So we start this simulation with a torus or Polish donut of plasma orbiting a black hole, and we put in a seed magnetic field, and then there's an instability that causes the torus to become turbulent and to accrete onto the black hole. So you can see the instability develops first in inner parts of the torus where the dynamic time is shortest, and then eventually the entire torus winds up in a turbulent, sort of quasi-stationary state, statistically steady state, and its mass flows. Okay, so this is a two-dimensional cut through a three-dimensional accretion flow. Most of our models are based on fully three-dimensional calculations. Okay, so after we run that, we've spent a million CPU hours doing the disk evolution. We post-process and calculate the version of radiation. And the key points here are the radiative processes that go into producing photons. So it's mainly synchrotron emission. And because the optical depth is close to one, at the wavelengths of interest, the 1 millimeter, where we can do this BLDI work, that synchrotron absorption is also important. And then, as I mentioned early on, Compton upscattering these millimeter photons produce X-ray photons. And that's all included in these emissions. Synchrotron and bremsstrahlung are sort of the only candidate emission processes here because there aren't any bound electrons. The plasma is fully ionized. And so you might think one should include bremsstrahlung, but it turns out to be negligible close to the black hole where all photons are produced, virtually all photons are produced. Further away from the black hole, synchrotron becomes less important. So we do not include Bremsstrahlung. Then we calculate the synchrotron emission assuming a thermal model for the distribution of the electrons. Solve the radiative transfer equation in two ways. One is using time-dependent ray tracings. Track back along GNSS and integrate the relativistic transport equation. And the other way is through Monte Carlo. So we sample photons as they're produced and track them out to cameras at large software cameras space large distance from the black. That's the Monte Carlo stuff was developed by my student Josh Goldman as part of his thesis group. So this shows the Monte Carlo samples as they're emitted and transported in one of our simulations. And the samples, or superphotons, are coded according to the photon energy. So the red photons are millimeter wave photons, that's the BLDI stuff. The green superphotons are infrared. It's a thing that produces the flares that are detected in the Keck and the very large marginal VLT. And the blue is the X-ray. So those are produced by Compton upstack. So you can see, as we zoom in on the black hole, and watch these photons run around, orbit the black hole. The gravitational lensing is very important. So many of the photons are produced close enough to the black hole that they wind up on close to the photon orbit, and actually execute several cycles around the black hole. Large distance that are detected. So this shows the result of the ray tracing calculations.
Do you have any images of field one?
What's that?
Do you have any images of the field one?
I don't. You can almost see the field lines in this image, because the fluctuations in magnetic field strength are strongly correlated along the field lines. And so these features that you see there are actually those field lines. Lens and stuff. Hard to understand, right? Geometry. But for the most part, in the disk, the field lines were oriented in toroidal direction. That's the dominant
part. You get a natural toroidal component.
And then there's a natural toroidal component. So in the what's called a funnel, which is an empty region over the poles of the black hole, there's a nearly toroidal magnetic field with small toroidal components induced by the rotation of the black hole. This is a so-called Langmuir's time. We can actually go into the simulations and match the magnetic field geometry to the analytic Langmuir-Snyak magnetic field geometry and see if we're doing the right thing. They agree very well. Okay. So this is an image of the black center source at 1 millimeter. With color showing the log intensity of the sky. And what we think the VLBI work is detecting is this bright spot on one side of the black hole, which you can see is small compared to the apparent size of the event horizon, which is about like this. In the case of this rotating black hole, it's a spin parameter. It's a fairly rapidly rotating black hole. So the reason there's a bright spot on one side of the hole is that the big plasma is in the disk, it's orbiting the hole, and the stuff on the left side is approaching us, and so the emission is not looking toward us. And likewise, this side is not orbiting. This ring here is what the Event Horizon Telescope hopes to detect, and that is the signature of the photon orbit around the black hole. If we look back along those lines of sight, we wind up almost on the photon orbit. And so there's a long path line through the emitting plasma that produces a bright ring.
So this body that's being pointed in three, what do you get?
I'm sorry?
The body that's being that you chose here.
So where do you get that?
So you're just trying different values?
Yeah, so we've tried different values. Yeah, and I'll explain in a minute what some of the constraints are on spin and the temperature and the location of the
But it's going to be part of your claim that that this would be your best?
This actually is our best bet model, but that's not really what I'm going to be talking about. I think, Adrian and I probably disagree about this, but I think that it's a little early to fit the parameters and details of this uncertainty in the model, particularly those related to the electron distribution. But Avery fits a different model of the accretion flow that gets quite tight constraints on some of these parameters. Okay. I wouldn't characterize our height constraints as being realistic measurement errors. I think there's a big systematic.
It's exactly what you want to say. It's a constraint on policies. Yeah. Strong constraint on policies. Okay, so give me just a moment, and I'll try and show you where the constraints come from in the observations. Okay. And actually, this is yet another information that may help a little bit. So this shows how this 1 millimeter image changes as we change the inclination of the black hole, always assuming that the disk is in the equatorial plane of the black hole. So now the disk is turning, so it's face on. So we're looking straight down this empty region of the poles of the hole. And you can see the emitting region is a ring on the sky, which will be detectable by the Event Horizon Telescope if it exists once a few more face ons are added. And then we come back down to almost 90 degrees inclination, nearly edge on. And now most of the emission is confined to a spot on one side of the black hole. Okay, now we're changing the observing frequency. So we started at 1 millimeter and the observing frequency is going down, so the plasma is becoming progressively more and more opaque. And there's a photosphere that produces the emission further out. We go back to 1 millimeter. And finally, turn the frequency up for the infrared, and you can see that the emission becomes more and more concentrated around this photon orbit, where the path planks are largest, and where the path goes through a piece of the plasma, where the field strength and temperature are highest, and so the highest frequency photons are produced.
How thick is the disk compared to the size of the black hole?
How thick?
I was trying to get a sense of the z-axis, because it looks pretty
yeah.
thin. It looks like it's pretty concentrated, just basically the size of the event horizon.
Yeah. So let me go back to this, which may give you a sense.
Yeah.
So this is a slice in the equatorial plane of the Resnais density. And you can see that this is log Resnais density. So the thickness is around characteristic height to radius of that 0.3, which some people have argued is not thick enough. Maybe the temperature in our model is too low. But having said that, it's a pretty thick disk, particularly compared to sort of standard Shakura Sinaia models, which are all thin disk models for visual that you learn about in graduate school. Okay, so getting back to your question about constraining the parameters, this shows a spectrum of a series of these models. And there's a here's the millimeter, here's the synchrotron bump, and here's the X-ray and infrared emission that's produced by singly scattered photons. And these are the observational constraints. This is the X-ray measurement, which is sort of an upper limit on the X-ray emission from SETI star quiescent state. And so any of our steady state models which produce an X-ray emission above that are ruled out by the observations. So these different models here show different values of the spin, running from 0.5 up to 0.98. And you can see that as you increase the spin, you increase the X-ray emission. In fact, for these parameters, these high spin models produce too much X-ray information. And the reason this emission goes up as the spin increases is that
most of the X-ray emissions produced near the innermost stable circular orbit. And as one increases the spin, that goes deeper in potential. So the gas is hotter there, and it's denser as well, because it's geometrically smaller. Same accretion rate has to go through that. And so the so both the temperature and the Thomson optical depth of the flow go up as the spin increases.
Charles,
yeah.
Does the X-ray emission scale with Mohs?
Does the X-ray emission...
So in other words, if you're dealing with more massive, so the mass of the black hole. So as you scale it up to the, you know, the 10 to the 9 solar mass black holes, how do those things?
Yeah, so it sort of depends on what else you hold with the constant. In fact, it doesn't depend on what else you hold constant. Is there any other parameters in the model?
Is it a general feature, though, that X-ray emission will increase as the spin increases even the larger system?
So what we hold constant in these models is the millimeter emission, which is fairly steady, fluctuates by maybe 30% or 50%. And so at fixed millimeter emission, the X-ray to millimeter color is an increasing function of spin. That's the...
What about for the field figures?
I'm sorry.
What binds for the field?
For the magnetic field? So the magnetic field is, in some sense, produced naturally by the magnetic field strength is set naturally by the fluid simulation. In some sense, because there is some dependence on initial conditions.
Right.
But there are two ways I can answer your question specifically. So one has to do with the ratio of the magnetic pressure to the gas pressure. And that's about 5 to 10% in these models. And another way is in terms of Gauss. So in the Galactic Center, these models have fields which are typically
30 Gauss. Right, but this isn't a model, but I mean, you're assuming, then you're trying to make contact with observations. So could fudge those and they move the curve around?
The magnetic field is not a free parameter in the model. So the within this model state, it's not a free parameter. So the one thing that we could try and do is use a set of initial conditions with different initial geometry for the magnetic field. And those tend to produce, there are certain configurations that produce stronger fields near the black hole. So these are the MCAP models that John McKinney has produced. And it's one of the most interesting open questions. What's the right initial conditions to use? How do you set up these experiments to best represent the large scale information bases that we think are there? Because all of us have to start with some finite torus. As a way of modeling this extended, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of them.
Just before you leave that, I think on the really long wavelengths, it looks like you're missing radiation. Is that just coming from further out? You're not similar?
Yeah, it's coming from further out, believed that those photons are produced by non-thermal electrons. So there's a, in fact, some of these photons are probably produced by non-thermal electrons, which is a good model. It's sort of a 30% contribution to the flux. So at that level, the models are precise. It's just interesting to get a radio transport physics that says that the source function of the outer parts of the disk, which is the emissivity divided by the opacity, has emissivity which is set by the non-thermal electrons and opacity which is set by the thermal electrons. So you have this situation where most of the emission out here is is this five? Yeah. What's the emission? Okay, so this gets back into the models, just what we constrain the parameters at all. Those are the six parameters in our model. So for these aligned accretion flows, there's an overall inclination, black hole spin, ion to electron temperature ratio. So we're producing a model for the electron distribution function, which assumes that the electrons are thermal, they have a temperature risk, which is a fixed fraction of the ion temperature. And ion temperature is given by the simulations. And then there's an accretion rate and the mass of the black hole that isn't supplied. So how can we constrain this? Well, first of all, the S-star observations tell us what the mass and the distance are. So that reduces the dimensionality of the parameter space time too. And then the 1 millimeter flux we use to normalize the density of the accretion flow. And so that effectively sets the mass accretion rate. Then the VLDI imaging can help constrain the inclination. So as I showed you in that movie, if the source is polon, it's a ring on the sky, and future VLDI observations will be able to cleanly distinguish between that and edge-on flow. And then the VLDI imaging also tells us about the electron temperature. Because we've resolved the source, we know it's optically fit, and we know what the flux is. And so that tells us immediately what the temperature of the emitting electron is. And finally, the X-ray flux, as I showed in the last slide, constrains the spin. So if we make the spin too large, we'll overproduce X-ray. So we can get some handle on that.
Charles, I'm sorry. Yeah. Could you explain again how to get M-dot from the 1 millimeter flux?
Yeah, so these simulations are scale-free in the sense that we have freedom to set the density normalization in the accretion flow. And that sets the density of the emitting electrons and the magnetic field strength.
Yes.
So we dial that parameter up and down until we match like a millimeter flux.
You mentioned something about, but how do you choose the model of the accretion disk? I mean, what are the characteristics that you go up with? You know, that is pinned down.
Sorry, so you're worried about what's going on further out?
Yeah.
Well, almost all the emission in these low accretion ray systems come from close to the event horizon. So if we have a faithful model of the plasma close to the event horizon, then we don't care about what happens further out. Now, whether we have a faithful model of what's going on close to the event horizon or not is not entirely clear because of some of these questions
and this,
mentioned regarding the initial conditions.
But in this geometry itself?
The disk geometry itself, so I'm not sure what you
mean. Well, height?
Well, the height is set by the temperature, and the temperature is approximately variable. There's a question about that, how close you get to the variable. Again, some of these models that start with very large initial disks seem to move slightly closer to variable temperature distributions. But it's not a free parameter.
Yeah, I think the biggest uncertainty here, Charles, may disagree, is the neglect of the non thermal electrons, which you already saw critical for the low frequencies.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to make a model in which you could neglect them totally, you need them to be really important here and then suddenly stop being important at the moment you're above. And at least it's hard for me to do that. So. But this is very unconstrained. We don't really know how to get there in the first place.
Yeah, I agree with that actually. Well, you know, there are a lot of uncertainties here regarding assumption of the tilt flow as well. And so I think these are sort of exploratory calculations. But the absence of non-thermal electrons is important.
What's the absolute temperature scale?
What's the what?
Absolute temperature scale.
Absolute temperature. The electron, dimensionless electron temperature, KT over MC squared, is of order 30 in the regions that are doing most of the mission. Okay, so thank you for the lead in to this slide, which shows discussion of some of the uncertainties in the model. So one important uncertainty just has to do with how energy is fed into the electrons. What's the absolute energy content of the electrons versus the ions? Because the system is collisionless, it's not clear how dissipation occurs in these systems. And as the energy goes down the turbulent cascade, how much winds up in electrons, how much winds up in ions. Another important uncertainty is electron anisotropy. So at least in solar wind, which is also collisionless, when the in solar wind, which is also nearly collisionless, the electron distribution function is well described by two temperatures. So one temperature parallel to the magnetic field, one perpendicular to the magnetic field. Because there aren't collisions that couple those two directions to isotropize the distribution function. So we'd like to include a model of electron and isotropy. Another important uncertainty that we're working on now is conduction. So again, nearly collisionless plasma, electrons can carry energies over large scales. And from hot parts of the flow to the cooler parts of the flow. And that means that in these regions where a lot of dissipation is occurring, you might energize electrons that then move out and bind other electrons further out and unbind them. So conduction could play an important role. And finally, a non-thermal component. Discussing so there's a lot of room for movement.
So you haven't mentioned winds. So you don't see winds being launched.
We do see winds being launched. So there's unbound material. So the geometry looks like this. There's a dense disk here in the colloidal plane, and then there's a nearly empty region here. And there's a pointing flux coming out here. And then in this region right here, along the walls of this nearly empty funnel, there's material that's heated and sufficiently far up the gravitational, sufficiently far up the gravitational potential that can become of that and flows. So there's a plasma wind there.
And how does that m dot compare to this? M dot in, m dot out, m dot in?
Yeah, it depends on the model parameters, but I would say, you know, in this particular model, it might be 10%.
Yep. Exactly something that might cause this
sort of
weather, right? Sorry, might. You transport energy close in further out,
yep.
Then drive mass loss. It all leads.
Yeah, so that was what I was trying to describe crudely. Yeah, so if you have an energy flux down here where dissipation is occurring, hot plasma to transport by electrons up here, heat this plasma, then it goes from being bound to unbound and flows out. Okay. So onward to an application of this stuff. So these models of black hole emission flows. What about disks which start out tilted? So So instead of having a model like this, which is orbiting an equatorial plane of the black hole, what if we tilt the angular momentum vector of the accretion plasma? So again, this angular momentum vector not aligned with the black hole spin, which is a situation that may be typical. So this shows one type of accreting black hole system. This is an X-ray binary. This is meant to show a system called GX339, where you have a companion star losing mass through a process called Roche Lobo overflow into an accretion disk around the black hole. And typically, the outer disk here will have an angular momentum vector which is aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the binary system. And the disk will only be aligned with the black hole spin if the black hole spin happens to be aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the binary as well. And it's not clear why they should be exactly aligned, as the orbital parameters are set in the supernova explosion, which forms the system at the time the black hole gets a substantial kick. Okay. So another example of an accreting black hole system with a tilted disk is this famous Baser source NGC 4258. So in this system, again using BLPI, we detect water laser spots on the sky at these positions here and here. And one can measure the velocities of these quite precisely, and it's possible to understand the system in detail with a model in which the gas is on circular orbits, and the circular orbits are tilting slightly at slightly different angles. So this is an existence proof for a disk in which the angular momentum vector of the disk is changing the radius. Okay. So again, this may be a typical case where disks are tilted. So an important dynamical feature of these systems is that once the orbits here, which you can think of as representing the accretion disk of three orbits, are tilted, then they precess. And they precess because the orbital frequency differs from the vertical frequency of the particle, which is the orbital. So these guys have a line of nodes which precesses forward along the orbit over time. And the precession rate is proportional to the spin of the hole divided by the q with the radius at leading order spin. So the precession rate is a function of radius. The rings precess at different rates at different radii. But then they're coupled together by fluid stresses. So the pioneering simulations in this paper done by Christopher about 6 years ago, we followed up with simulations of tilted disks, which produce a density structure which is remarkably different from the density structure of the untilted disks. So the untilted disks have sort of an axisymmetric, quasi-axisymmetric inflow of material down to the innermost stable circular orbit and into the black hole. These tilted disks have two plunging streams. Two streams of material that enter the black hole along the line of nodes of the inner disk. And they start plunging outside the innermost stable circular orbit, in fact, two further out. So what do we know about these tilted disks? Well, first of all, it's obvious that there are now two new parameters in the model, two new angles to describe the tilt. And then the material, instead of being distributed axisymmetrically, is concentrated in these plunging streams, which have a higher density, higher temperature, and higher magnetic field. than axisymmetric disk, which produces the same millimeter flux.
But what you said, you start planning from beyond the disk, putting what disk of disk for orbits at that inclination, or the disk of.
Yeah, so. Beyond the ISCO orbits of that information.
Okay.
So the ISCO surface looks sort of like a football for tilted orbits. It's a
football
game.
It's spherical thing.
What's that?
You guys are confusing me with what it's called. American football?
Yeah, it's American football. Yeah.
Okay.
Real
football.
Real
football.
Yeah,
I think it's circular. It's spherical.
So anyway, it's pointed along the axis. So it's further away along the axis, and then it's more or less independent of radius close to the equatorial plane. So we think this happens because the inner disk, well, first of all, the definition of the innermost stable circular orbit is the point where d squared l of r squared is equal to 0. That's epicyclic frequency equal to 0. So the epicyclic frequency, sorry, the angular momentum rises only very gradually away from the innermost stable circular orbit. And so if you apply even a small torque to the inner disk, you can drop the angular momentum below the angular momentum of the disco and stuff will fall in. So we think that the tilt sets up the standing wave pattern. Standing wave results in shocks. The shocks torque the plasma and it falls. Okay. So what effect does the tilting disk have on the spectrum? Well, as I said, it increases the temperature and field strength. And that means that there's more emission in the infrared compared to an untilted model. It means there's more X-ray emission than in the untilted models. So this shows, again, here's the whole spectrum of frequency from the millimeter here, the infrared and the X-ray, and this is the mu L mu luminosity. For untilted disk, 15 degree tilt, and 30 degree tilt. So you can see infrared emission is a monotonically increasing function of tilt. And you know, getting back to Avery's point about the absence of non-thermal electrons which produce infrared emission, if you overproduce infrared emission with a thermal model, way overproduce the infrared emission of a non-thermal model. Although everything is tied together, so it's
If you normalize your millimeter flux, or your m dot, by setting the millimeter flux, keeping only the thermal electrons, that's true.
Yeah,
the non-thermal electrons also
in the
model.
Yeah, I think that the non-thermal electrons matter outside the thermal distribution, right? They dominate the emission outside the thermal distribution.
They dominate, but they're not.
And that's the that's the region that produces.
To renormalize the thermal component down by a factor of half.
Okay, but I think the overriding message is that the spectrum is sensitive to tilt. And if you increase the infrared emission and increase the X-ray emission substantially by tilt.
Is that just because you create regions of high density? Can you trace it back to that alone?
Yeah, so it's again, with the normalization. So you're reducing, for a given mass accretion rate, you're reducing the millimeter flux. So you have to raise the mass accretion rate a little bit to match the millimeter flux. And then There's also a higher temperature, which is independent of normalization, and higher magnetic fields, which are not independent of normalization.
Is that the mass accretion rate that actually crosses the event horizon?
That is one way to measure it, but I'm really just speaking about the overall normalization of the density. And
whatever the region,
mass accretion rate you're measuring, they all go up and down together with this normalization.
It's just your density scale.
It's the density scale, yeah.
It's fine.
Okay, so we're back on the final interesting result of these tilted disk models. So we said these tilted disks are two new parameters, which are the angles of describing tilt. So that enlarges the parameter space significantly, or makes it harder to constrain models in the lack of center and negative 7. This plot shows that the spectrum, here again, frequency and nu, is more or less independent of the longitude of one of those angles at which you observe the system. So this is longitude with respect to the black hole coordinate system. So we can look at it from any direction. And the peak emission here changes only by 50 or 70%. The peak emission here changes only by about 50 or 70%, which is a small change in this distance. So we can reduce the size of the parameter space. And you can see that this is a small change, particularly compared to the amplitude of the change here, which is almost two orders of magnitude in infrared and maybe three orders of magnitude in X-ray. So much more sensitive to the tilt than to the longitude. Okay, so here's the summary. Motivation for this work, galactic center, M87, resolving the event horizon. We've produced this numerical laboratory, which includes both dynamical simulation and radio transport calculations. And we've calculated a bunch of things, but the ones I've talked about today are the spectra of tilted disks and how that depends on tilt and wavelength. And the message is that the spectrum is nearly axisymmetric, and that the X-ray millimeter, red to millimeter colors are sensitive to this tilt.